Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. For those of you who listen regularly, I realize there's been an almost month-long gap since our last episode when we talked to Ingrid Thoft. It's not for lack of books being released, but more having to do with the prep work I need to do in order to be ready to be part of the faculty of the Mystery Writers Conference taking place at Book Passage in Corte Madera, California. I hope to more than make up for it to the listeners of Speaking of Mysteries in August. Now to episode 57. Our guest this time is Ace Atkins, whose fourth Quinn Colson novel, The Redeemers, is scheduled for publication tomorrow, July 21st, 2015. Ace talks a lot about the role the Deep South, where he lives, plays in the Quinn Colson series. As he tells me, there isn't necessarily more ne'er-do-well criminal types in the South. It's just that they might be louder and more colorful than in other parts of the country. We also talked about his other projects. As most of you know, Ace is the writer who is continuing Robert B. Parker's Spencer series. And Ace also talks about the rebirth, as it were, of Nick Travers from a much earlier series. Nick Travers is returning in a graphic novel very soon. Ace also writes for the Southern regional magazine, Garden and Gun. He recently wrote about Southern college football, and he contributed to Garden and Gun's Good Dog, a collection of essays about man's and woman's best friend. I'll include a link to Garden and Gun's description of Good Dog on the Speaking of Mysteries website. Here's Ace Atkins. This is Nancy Clare. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries, and I'm thrilled that our guest for this episode is Ace Atkins. Welcome, Ace.
Hey, Nancy. Good to be here.
You have a new book coming out, and we will time this podcast to the public pub date of The Redeemers. But before I ask you questions specifically about the book, I wanted to ask you more of a general question, and that is Quinn Colson an optimist?
That's a good question. I think he is. Yeah, I definitely think he is. It's a, you know, kind of a classic setup. I think he is grudgingly an optimist because he knows the realities of the world, and he knows the realities of the Southern community where he's the sheriff, but I do think he believes ultimately there's good.
Well, okay, that's kind of what I thought, although sometimes he can be very dark.
True.
In this book, in The Redeemers, which I just finished, which I enjoyed as much as I enjoy any Quinn Colson novel, I don't think, though, I've ever seen a more motley collection of bad guys. and to heap on the alliteration, the duplicity is dizzying. Let me ask you, what comes first in your stories, the crime or the criminal?
For me, it's the criminal. You know, for me, the characters are pretty much everything. And once I kind of get a sense of who's going to be in the book and who the players are, the crime comes after that. And I really spend most of my time thinking about who's going to be coming in. And they're very specific to the Deep South, and they're very specific to North Mississippi. And I will either find these people, you know, from the newspaper from being recently arrested, or I might have had the misfortune of running into them. But I spend a great deal of time thinking about who these people are before the story comes about.
Recently, you wrote in Garden and Gun about how college football is perhaps the South's most consistent common denominator. I always thought it was food, but without giving away any spoilers about the Redeemers, one of the most woebegone of the criminals lives for the Crimson Tide. You, of course, played for Auburn. Is that why you made him an Alabama fan?
Well, the short answer is yes, but the longer answer is the Alabama fan, I think, is somewhat common currency among Americans. I think that even if you live in California, you've seen the Alabama Crimson Tide fan on television. And you're familiar, I think, your entry into the insane world of Southern college football probably is through the University of Alabama. So, you know, as somebody who went to the rival university, I think I had a lot of fun, you know, writing about these guys who are not very flattering characters. But at the same time, I think they're people that nationally that would know these people and recognize them.
I want to digress a little bit from the book, if that's okay. And I want to ask you about Garden and Gun magazine. My friend John Maroney introduced it to me a few years back when he was writing for me at the Los Angeles Times magazine. And so because of it, I think of myself as a vicarious Southerner. Mm. Can you explain the place Garden and Gun occupies in Southern culture and the heart of its Southern readers to those who are listening who are not from the South?
Yeah, I think Garden and Gun is probably a more sophisticated version of maybe what people recognize with Southern living, that kind of, you know, is more of a, you know, home magazine and that kind of thing. Garden and Gun is much more expansive, you know, with feature stories about Southerners and about Southern culture. And I guess I would say that it's a little bit edgier in the fact that, you know, writes a lot about, you know, whiskey and unusual characters. And I think that what I like about the magazine and writing for them, and I've done some stuff for their books, mainly actually for some of the Garden Gun essay books that they put together, is I think that it represents a lot of the good about the South as far as Southern culture. And, you know, we have no shortage down here of the bad stuff. And most notably in the last few months, you know, as we always say, it's not that we have more crazy people or more evil people. They just tend to be louder down South than they are in other parts of the country. And I think that's very much true. So I think that in some ways, Garden and Gun is kind of an ambassador for the good things to like about the South. Being racially progressive, the shared interest in food and music and that kind of stuff. So that's what I like it's nice to write for a magazine that has that point of view.
And I should say some of the stories are amazing. I mean, I saw that they have now a collection of essays about dogs, and I have to get it.
I contributed to that one. I wrote about an old hound dog that I had that was a walker hound, and I wrote a piece about him in that particular book.
Well, then now I truly have to get it, and I will make sure there's a link on the website.
Absolutely.
You brought this up, and I do my best to steer clear of politics when I speak to writers, but, you know, for those of us here in the States, the South has been very much in the national news, and I've always felt that corruption and its companion crime can be found anywhere. As you said, maybe the South is just louder. I mean, Illinois and New Jersey probably have the same proportion of crooked politicians and criminals as Mississippi and Alabama. But is there anything particularly unique about crime in the South, or is it the uniqueness in the crime fiction writers who tell the stories?
Well, I think we don't have as many people that write about the South. I think that the South sometimes occupies a place in movies and books that, you know, somewhere between, you know, Mississippi Burning and The Help, you know, and it's always kind of polarized. It's either all the way evil, or it's, you know, it's just, you know, it's a little bit lighter touch. And, you know, for me, I think the thing that makes Southern crime and Southern corruption interesting to write about is we have such a history of ignoring it. And I think, you know, I also write books that are set in Boston, and writing about corruption and things that happen in Boston, people are a little bit quicker to call folks on corruption and things that are going wrong. I think there's more of an attitude of spotlighting people, both as journalists, but also in the public. And I think down South, there's such an attitude that's been pervasive of looking the other way, and of that classic thing of good men doing nothing, of we don't want to agitate, you know, even if it's wrong, let's not make any trouble. And, you know, we saw that, you know, going back to the civil rights era, where people knew we clearly had an issue of right or wrong, but we didn't have enough people speaking up for the right. And that's still very true today. You know, corruption is not spotlighted. We don't have, unfortunately, enough journalists to shine the light on what really goes on in local politics. And there's such a very old-fashioned, good old boy network. And the classic Southernism is that's just the way things evolve.
Well,
and that's what's interesting for me to write about. And somebody, to be able to write about a character like Quinn, who challenges that system of just because that's the way things have always been, does not make it right.
And you really get into that in The Redeemers, because there seems to be, without any spoilers, there seems to be sort of a tolerable amount of corruption, you know, just enough for people to sort of coexist with it. And then, as so often happens, the person, the criminal just gets a little bit greedier, and it just pushes it over the edge. And that, to me, is very much what happened in The Redeemers. Like, it was, as you said, you know, most of the people in the county would sort of go along to get along. It, you know, it wasn't out of hand. It didn't encroach on most people's lives. And then it did.
Yeah, I think that's just the way, you know, it always works, is just pushing somebody a little bit too far, and for that corruption getting to the place where it's out of hand. I think that even where I live, people understand there's corruption going on and there's, you know, payoffs and that kind of thing. But as long as it's not overt and as long as it's not in somebody's face, they don't necessarily make trouble. But, you know, when, you know, secrets get out and then people start pointing fingers, you know, of course, that's where the good noir house of cards falling down comes in.
Yeah, and that very much happens in The Redeemers. There are just moments in that story where weak people get talked into things that they shouldn't be doing, and really evil people, you never think that they're going to get their comeuppance. I thought a very well constructed dance of corruption. It really did a great job.
I appreciate that. I really appreciate that. And that's something that I really kind of pride myself in trying to do, which is to represent the way that real crime works. And, you know, I've never been interested in writing big over-the-top thriller or something about, you know, larger-than-life characters or whatever. I mean, I really am interested in writing about things that I encountered both as a journalist, the things that I just encountered here locally in Mississippi, and the way that really crime works. And the writers that I've always been drawn to always have that root in reality. I mean, you know, for me, you know, my background would be studying Elmore Leonard and George Higgins, and those are the books that, although not set in the South, I think I certainly share their point of view on life.
It's funny that you brought up Elmore Leonard, because one of the things I was privileged to do in my previous part of my career was have Megan Abbott interview Mr. Leonard.
Yeah.
And he said something about criminals and his criminal characters as, for the most part, being just so stupid. You can't believe that they have gotten as far as they have. Now, not all your criminals are stupid, not by a long shot.
But several of them are.
But one in particular who was also the Alabama fan, I have to add, is so deeply, profoundly stupid, and so much fun to read. But I have to wonder that as you were writing him, were you feeling that maybe you were slipping into stereotype, or that it just, these guys just really do exist?
They really are. I mean, the jails are not full of very smart people, to say the least. And, you know, when you really think about somebody who has a job as a petty thief, you know, their worldview and their outlook on things is, you know, they definitely have the common touch. And there'll be points where, you know, I'll have my wife, who's also a former journalist, is always my first reader. And we'll get to a point and I'll say, you know, have I taken this guy too far? Is this guy just too much of a redneck? Is he just too much of a peckerwood? And then we'll be somewhere out in public, and we're both eavesdroppers and listening to somebody talk, and we both decide, I did not go far enough. So that's really how it is. I mean, you know, there's, I think if I was truly maybe even taking that character to the absolute of authenticity, the way that the Southern Peckerwood criminal is, I think that, you know, it may not even be understandable by some readers. But, yeah, that's just the way it is.
He's just a brilliantly drawn character, and you can almost hear this guy speaking. All of your language is very evocative of conversations, but this guy just, you know, I found myself laughing out loud. I hope that that's not an insult.
Well,
if it is, I will edit it out.
Well, that's really my intention. And again, the writers who are really just had such a big influence on me, and you know, going back to the ones that, you know, would write about crime, but also had a more of a dark comic touch to them. And again, Leonard and George Higgins and Robert Parker, and those books really, you know, there's darkness and there's crime, but there's also some humor too. And, you know, it's like reading those dumb criminal stories in the paper. You just, you know, end up laughing at what these people are pulling off. And in this case, you know, it's just a, which starts off as a simple, a heist in somebody's house, robbing a personal safe, just starts unraveling. And it actually is based on a true story. It's based on something that happened here in North Mississippi. And to me, when I read about the actual real case, it read like something out of the Coen brothers, the unraveling after the crime was committed and people playing against each other. It's never the crime itself. It's what is the fallout and the people who quickly turn on each other. And when I read it, I said, this is almost like something from the Coen brothers. And I've got to, a friend of mine who's an attorney brought it to my attention. And whether it's good or bad, I took it as a compliment, but I don't know if it was. He said, these people sound like Ace Atkins kind of people. So I took it as a compliment. But later when I read about it, I said, I don't know if that's a compliment at all. But, you know, that's just, you know, again, that's life. And that's the way it works. It's funny and it's tragic and it's dark. And you know, if you get some laughs out of it, that's certainly what I intend.
Okay, well, then I won't feel bad about that. You know, you self-identify as a Southerner. You didn't just play football for Auburn. You played on the 93 undefeated team. You live in Oxford, Mississippi, which is the heart of Southern letters, or at least us
sure.
Yankees think of that. But you channeled the mind of a Yankee in the continuation of the Robert B. Parker or Spencer series. Is that a hard thing for you to do? Is it hard to change the... Because it's not just sort of the thinking, and as you pointed out, the way people react to things in the North, especially in Boston, is got to be much different than Mississippi.
It is hard. I mean, it's tougher for me to write a Spencer novel that you know, in design and in execution may look a little bit easier because the stories are usually not as complex as when I'm writing about Quinn and I'm writing about the Mississippi books that are, you know, have several different characters and that kind of thing. I'm writing really from just Spencer's point of view. But I'm now working on my fifth Spencer book, and, you know, although I know that character very well and I grew up, you know, just idolizing Robert B. Parker and studying his work and just being, you know, somebody who really taught me how to write, getting into that Boston mindset is the toughest part. And I really kind of approach it like a journalist. I almost look at Boston as being one of my beats. And, you know, I go up there, I spend, you know, every few months I'm up there, and I'm not just walking on Beacon Hill. You know, I'm in Dorchester, and, you know, last time I was there, I hung out the fire, you know, Union Hall, and I got to hang out with Boston Fire Department. And so I really pay attention to that stuff, and I don't want Spencer to ever not be, have a regional feel to it. I want to have that Boston authenticity, but it's something that is not, you know, my own backyard, and it is different, but, you know, I take pride in doing it. And the other part of that that's difficult is I'm not just writing about Boston. I'm writing about Boston in the voice of another writer. And that's really the hardest part of it all is the Boston stuff I can learn, but writing as another in a different voice that not is not my own is much more tricky.
Well, you did anticipate one of my next questions, and I'm thankful that there is going to be another Spencer novel. But I also wanted to add that writing in a spare and straightforward way, like the Robert B. Parker Spencer novels are, is, I think, infinitely more difficult than, it's harder to say something in few words than it is in a lot of words.
Absolutely. No, it really is. And I think people, it's always, Parker's work has always been, I think, deceptively simple to people who are not writers. And, you know, when I go back and I read Bob's work, I'm just still so impressed. I'll get to a point of just a sentence or a little bit. And I'm rereading one of his books from the mid-80s, and there's just this three-sentence description of Spencer's in San Francisco. And it reads, this three-sentence, just little, you know, descriptor of downtown San Francisco, it reads like something almost like a poem, like Robert Frost. It's just this deceptively simple, beautiful design of these sentences. Just, you know, in the middle of this early chapter in this book, Catskill Eagle, he's just a wonderful writer. And the trick for me is not the writing, it's a lot of the subtraction. And when I write a scene with Spencer and I'm writing something for one of the new Spencer books, I spend equally as much time taking away words as I do writing. And he was just a master of that spare prose, and it is not easy. It may look easy, it may look spare, it may only look like, you know, there's dialogue and there's a little bit here and there, but it is tough. It is tough. He was a phenomenal writer.
Well, it's one of those situations where every word has weight, and there can't be any superfluous words, and every, like you said, just, you know, a three-word sentence.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that I think that helped me into being able to write the Spencer books is my background as a reporter, because as a reporter, you've got to say a lot in a limited amount of space. And anyone who's ever worked as a reporter, when you say, look, you got a 10-inch story, well, God, you got to get the best stuff in there. And you got to make your lead really work. And you've got to have the impact of each word. And it's really terrific training. And in much the same way, people forget, you know, people always talk about Bob's background as an academic, which he really actually despised being an academic. But, you know, his background out of college was writing copy, and he was an ad guy. And, you know, just like Elmore Leonard, Elmore was an ad guy, and he had to make the maximum impact in a little amount of space. And it's kind of the same thing, very much the same thing you do as a reporter.
You know, you got to get it all in the lead, and you've got to hook them, and then hope that they stick around for the rest of the jump. So back to Quinn Coulson, and he certainly never shies from a challenge, and he faces plenty of them, personal and professional, in the Redeemers. But what's next for him? Because I'm assuming from, no spoilers, but I'm assuming from where we left off in the Redeemers that Mr. Coulson will be back.
Yes, as long as he's welcome at the G.P. Putnam Sons, then he will continue to come back. I think the thing about Quinn, what I wanted to do, I've written a series before. When I was in my 20s, I had a character named Nick Travers. I had New Orleans, and I did four books, and people asked me what I remember about those books. And although I really enjoyed writing those as a young writer, I learned a lot about, limiting your character and not being able to have enough stories in them. And we've all come to the point where we read about a character or a series where you feel like there's not more to tell, and or you feel like the stories are repetitive. And so when my editor, I had actually been writing at Putnam, a terrific editor who's been my editor since 2004, named Neil Meyer. And Neil and I had worked on four books that were novels based on true stories. They were, I don't want to call them historical novels, but they were, one of the books was about Machine Gun Kelly, another one was about the Fatty Arbuckle trial in the 1920s. I mean, they were very, very different. They were very true to life. They were crime fiction, but, you know, had a larger expanse. So at some point, it was impressed upon me by Neil and Putnam, said, you know, series characters are very popular. Would you consider writing another one? You know, I said, I'm not sure, because I really didn't think my career was headed to create something else like that. Anyway, I mulled it over, but the main thing that I wanted to do was to have something that had limitless possibilities. And the setup of Quinn, this is a very long answer to your question, the setup of Quinn is that, you know, it's a story as old as the Odyssey. He's the soldier who's returned home, and he finds his home absolutely in shambles. And, you know, finds the woman that he loves is, you know, with somebody else, and he finds out that his family is, you know, kind of spread out. And so those issues have not been addressed. So not only do I have whatever is the particular crime in each book, but I also have a lot of family issues. And I really look at the books to be equally about the county overall. So Tippahaw County, Mississippi is a equally important part. You know, the book may be misleading when you see a Quinn Colson novel on the front. It's not just a hero-driven story. There's a lot of facets to those towns. So yeah, I feel, you know, as long as people are reading them and they're excited about them, and I'm going to continue writing, because I do see Quinn having after coming home, could become sheriff, having limitless possibilities.
Well, it's funny that you brought up Nick Travers, because I read on your website that he's coming back in a graphic novel.
I just read the graphic novel this morning. I just saw it in completion. I had seen it in pieces. The artist had been sending me, you know, bits and pieces here and there, and I had kind of knew where it was headed, and he just does this brilliant work. But this morning he had sent it to me, and I read it on an iPad and was able to scroll through it and see the whole thing. And it's funny that the graphic novel is based on it is the short story that I wrote years ago, and it was the first Nick Travers story that I ever wrote, and this was maybe a year out of college, and so I was only about 25 years old when I wrote this. And so it's pretty cool to see it come full circle and now see it, you know, as an illustration and see the whole story come to life. And it was something that I wrote and wasn't sure would ever get published and ultimately did, but it's pretty cool. So I think that my original creation with Nick Travers, that original series, is going to have a second life in the graphic novel world for sure.
I think that that's a very exciting part of the genre now, the move into graphic novels. When I understand Denise Mina is translating the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo stories into graphic novels. There's something very immediate about reading in that way, and I find I absorb them differently. It's a different experience.
I think so. And stylistically, they're so beautiful. I think there's so much that if you're into crime books and you're really into, you know, really the classic feel of noir and crime fiction, there's so many of the aesthetics that get to be so much fun with them, with the artistry. And I look back with the Parker books that have been recently done. They're just are gorgeous, that IDW Publishing put out, and they're just fantastic. And that kind of hard-boiled imagery, I think, is just dead on perfect for the graphic novel style.
I appreciate your time so much, Ace, and talking about not just Redeemer, but Robert Parker's, but the Spencer series, and Nick Travers. And I look forward to seeing Nick Travers in graphic form. Thank you again.
Thank you, Nancy. Always fun talking with you.
Coming up in the next few weeks, Speaking of Mysteries will be talking to Vu Tran about his debut noir novel, Dragonfish, about the Vietnamese underground in Las Vegas. Martin Walker about Patriarch, his new Inspector Bruno mystery. Linda Fairstein about Devil's Bridge, her latest Alex Cooper crime novel. And just in time for pro football preseason, we hope to talk to Bill Sikin about his first mystery, Hangman's Game, about a punter whose last name happens to be Gallo. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.